Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Henrik here with Red Ice TV, and today we are talking with Frodi Midjord from Skanza Forum. We've actually been live streaming a few of their past events. We've also been there and recorded some of them, uploaded them to YouTube. Certainly not all of them, but a few of them. So welcome, Frodi. Good to talk to you. We haven't actually done a show. It's the first time we're meeting, so to speak, face-to-face here.
Yes, it's very good to be on your show. I've been following Red Ice for many years. I think I started listening to your show back in 2010, 2011, something like that.
Oh, early days.
So nice. Yeah. So I've been following you guys for a long time. And I have to say I'm very impressed with what you guys are doing, because I remember the times, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when nationalism and the right and so on, when it was basically based on mail order and magazines, and people had to order them actively and actively participate in a way, and that way it only reached, basically it was preaching for the choir, so to speak. But now you guys have almost 300,000 subscribers, so you're reaching a whole new level of audience, and you have an audiovisual content, so it's a completely different game, and you guys have really played a huge part in that, so I'm very impressed.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Yeah, we're doing the best we can. We're trying the best we can. We're almost at 300,000 now. It's going slow. It feels like, you know, and I'm sure you're aware of this too, of course. You have a new YouTube channel, fairly new, Guide to Culture. We'll talk more about that later. But YouTube as a platform, I tell you, it's just they're ruining it. Now, the latest news I saw about that is that they're having some clampdown on what they call, and we all know what this means, right? But conspiracy videos, right? Anything that basically questions the mainstream narrative, which is, if you're a listener from that far back, you know that we've been talking about everything from, you know, 9/11 to really out there conspiracies to more kind of down to earth, you know, issues that happens geopolitically and stuff like that. But that seems to be no more on YouTube, sadly.
Yeah, and not all of them are even political. And what's it called? Alex Jones, he was even thrown off.
Yep.
And well, it's I think they're getting a bit scared of losing their monopoly on the information. So usually you had big corporations, huge corporations with TV channels and newspapers and so on. But now it's more democratized, if we should use that term. But people are able to participate in the debate in a different way, and that means that the really big, powerful people are losing their monopoly. And I don't think they're very comfortable with that.
Yeah, look, quickly, we're going to talk about Skanza here, the work that you've been doing in a little bit. But as we're on the topic, I mean, check something like this out, right? YouTube's bet against big cable announces nationwide expansion. They're basically going into mainstream TV now. So you're going to be watching, you know, cable and HBO and all this crappy mainstream. I mean, again, what made YouTube great was you could get content that you would not get anywhere else, right? You could go down the rabbit hole, as they say, and some of their articles they've been releasing, they specifically talk about the danger of you searching for something and finding something, let's say, unconventional or something that goes against the mainstream narrative. And so now YouTube is basically turning into a mainstream platform. It's sad, you know?
Yeah, that's what was so charming about YouTube, and what is still charming about it. But I mean, yeah, this is a natural development, and it only means that we can't depend on these huge other companies. We have to build our own platforms. That's ultimately the end game, I would assume.
Yeah, definitely. The difficulty is piercing through, of course, and making a platform that appeals to people who normally wouldn't kind of travel in those spheres. But you know what? Let's return to that a bit later. We have a number of things lined up that we want to get into. Just tell us then about Skanza a little bit, and what prompted you to get going with that, why you wanted to start it, and how long you guys have been going right now.
Right. So basically a bit about me. I was born on the Faroe Islands, which is a tiny place in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It's 18 islands that were populated back in the Viking ages by Norwegians back then. And since then, it's been very much isolated. So it's still very much ethnically homogeneous, and which means it's basically crime free. So it's an oasis in the sea of multiculturalism, so to speak. When I was a kid, I moved from there, and I moved to Sweden. And what I immediately felt was that I was alienated by what I saw. I saw, you know, multiculturalism and the things we associate with the modern times and the modern values and so on. And I never really felt a part of that. So I didn't really feel that I did fit in that society. So I, when I became a teenager, I sort of searched for alternative literature, or not alternative literature, but more historical literature. Literature that displays other values from a different time, and I identified more with the historical roots of our people, and that's what I embraced more and more. And so I've basically followed white nationalism and nationalism since the late 90s, and then I started reading up on everything, you know. I became, you know, a huge collector of books, basically. I just collected lots and lots of books, and I read everything I could get my hands on these issues, on politics, philosophy, history, and these things. And when I got involved, I basically drew some conclusions that we are very much stuck in a paradigm where we think, or the modern mythology is that people are rational creatures. They gather information, gather arguments, they make logical conclusions about them, and then they vote, and we get the best system available through that process. But what I realized, and what lots of other people have realized, of course, and all successful political movements have realized, is that humans are not primarily just rational creatures. We're also social creatures and emotional creatures. So what I wanted to do with the Skanza Forum was to give people an arena, a space where they could meet and socialize. Because when the powerful people, the power structures, so to speak, when they don't like what we do, they don't give us any counter arguments to prove us wrong, to say why we have the wrong conclusions about multiculturalism and the modern society. Basically, what they do is they try to push us out of society. They try to socially isolate us, and one writer called this ritual defamation. Basically, they try to defame you. They try to push you out of polite society, and they try to mess with your opportunities to have a job. They try to isolate you socially from your family. People lose, you know, family, girlfriends, everything through this involvement in politics. So what we need, basically, and what I want to provide, and what I have provided with the Skanza Forum, is an arena where people can actually meet in real life. Of course, we have the speeches, always good speeches, really great speakers, intellectuals from all over the world. But the core value of this is that people can actually meet each other in a safe environment, because we also have vetting for who we let in. We don't let anonymous people in. We have to know who everyone is who gets in. And they can network, and they can get a real life social network that they can depend on. So, and that's a necessary condition for us to have a successful political movement at all. So the Skanza Forum got started in early 2017. We've had conferences all over Scandinavia, all the three Scandinavian countries, in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. Sweden already had a tradition of these conferences and these types of events, and you know, a nationalist movement and so on. Denmark and Norway didn't really have that. So in those two countries, we basically were sort of pioneers. We started something that was quite new for those countries in terms of these types of white nationalist events. And they have all, of course, had other types of events earlier, but not really of this kind. So I think we have contributed, and I'm very proud of that. We have contributed to starting a new way of interacting, and hopefully we'll continue to have an impact on that in the future as well.
Yeah, definitely. I want to ask you a bit more about Norway and Denmark. Sure. and just kind of where they are compared to Sweden right now as well. But before we do that, when you came to Sweden, you were 7, you said. Did you know any Swedish before that? Was that difficult getting into, you know, learning the language and getting into school and all that stuff?
No, well, I knew Well, all people from the Faroe Islands are fluent in Danish as well.
So oh, they
I
are?
Knew Danish.
Okay, yeah.
So I knew Danish. So Swedish was basically my third language. But when you're a kid, you learned very quickly. And, some people in Sweden have difficulties understanding Danish or Norwegian.
We do
so
for some
on.
Reason. I don't know what does that. Yeah. It's bizarre. You know, if I see it spelled out, it's easy, but it's just like a really thick dialect and some words are, you know, kind of counterintuitive in a way. But yeah, for some reason, they seem fine understanding Swedish though, so they have an advantage.
yeah. I think it's just the habit of interaction. I think Norwegians and Danish people tend to see more Swedish TV, for example, so they have an easier time probably understanding the language as well, just because their ears are used to hearing it. So
yep, that's true.
So that wasn't really the language was never really a problem for me. And now basically, since I've lived most of my life in Sweden, Swedish is basically my primary language or the language that I'm most advancedly, you know, used to. That's basically, yeah.
Great. So let's talk a bit about, obviously, the situation is very different in Sweden. Certainly, just going back 10 years, I know that things are changing in Norway, when it comes to immigration, when it comes to you know, questioning and talking about the issues of culture and nation and the need for preservation of those things, basically kind of like the way Sweden was, right? When Sweden wasn't multicultural, what was the need to talk about those things or even be concerned with those things? So how would you, what's the main difference in that regard, having a conference, let's say, in Norway compared to Sweden? You said things are more established in Sweden. People know what's going on. They know what they're concerned with and stuff. But in Norway, they haven't, at least some parts of Norway, Oslo is a little bit different maybe, but they don't have the same experiences there. So the need for a strong sense of nationalism from the point of view of preservation is maybe less needed. Would you say that's correct?
I wouldn't say actually it's less needed, but they have a different political culture, definitely. Yeah, like you said, Swedish political culture is very used to having this debate. It's been going on for decades. Nationalist movements and groups have been established for a long time. It has become a part of everyday Swedish political culture that this thing exists, whereas it really hasn't been like that in Norway. Norway is... Well, there are many, many contributing factors. Norway is also a country very much of valleys where you have had small isolated, small isolated communities throughout history. And they have been farming societies. Norwegians have, I get the impression, more recently moved into big cities where politics is more relevant in that way. So they are used to having small, very tightly knit communities with very strong social control, with these free churches and so on. Very high, you know, these churches have been high moral authorities, basically controlling what everyone believes. So Norwegians are extremely afraid of stepping outside of what is acceptable and not being part of the mainstream narrative. They are extremely sensitive. It is a huge difference for me compared to, you know, living in Sweden, where people, although, you know, there is this politically correct culture, which everyone in the world is now aware of, whereas Norwegians are far less comfortable with stepping outside of the boundaries of what is acceptable in the mainstream. So they are very much afraid of questioning these things. And another contributing factor is basically the mythology around the Second World War, when Norway was occupied by Germans, by the German forces. And one thing is the reality of that occupation. Another thing is the mythology created afterwards by the social democratic movement, basically, that has had total hegemony over Norwegian culture since then, just like it has in Sweden, so to speak. But when Germany occupied Norway, that was for strategic reasons, and actually the British were they had also landed in Narvik at the same time, you know, as the German forces won out. And during the whole period of time, there wasn't a huge resistance. The Norwegian resistance movement really took off toward the end of the war when Germany already had lost, basically. And the huge majority of Norwegians didn't take any sides. So maybe you had like 60% who were neutral and 20% who were pro-German, 20% who were anti-German, basically. But in the mythology after the war, they have really painted this occupation as extremely brutal. They had this probably one of the most shameful parts of Norwegian history is the treatment of what they call Tyske Töser, or the German girls, the women who had relations with German soldiers who were in Norway back then, and the way they had been treated, their offspring, basically the kids they had, they have been bullied, they cut their hair off, the women, and just to shame them, they raped them, they beat them really brutally, which is, of course, in stark contrast, Germans are North European peoples, and in contrast to how it is completely acceptable for women to have relations with people from the other side of the planet. So these things are, you know, apparently back then this national sovereignty was extremely important, which it isn't now. So it's all a part of a mythology to demonize everything that has to do with nationalism. So after the war, basically everything has been sort of subliminally connected to that period in time and has extremely much been demonized. So I do think that sort of mythology laying all over Norway like that has been a cover and has been a stopping block for creating a sane debate on these issues.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's true for most, but the Western European countries at this point, it's a creation mythology, basically, which, you know, put itself in place after the Second World War. And you're very right. It's for the sake of simplicity, the Socialist International, or as you said, the Democratic Socialist Order that kind of arose in the ashes of that, if you will, has really tried to establish itself. And I think it's been a necessity for them to demonize, for understandable reasons from their point of view, the opposition, right, which could dethrone them, if you will, and they need this kind of victim narrative as well for why do we need to move towards internationalism or globalism, and we're still very much in that same battle today, you know.
Yeah, and also just after we had our conference in Oslo, Police College in Oslo, a research group there dealing with counter-terrorism, basically, released a report that also pointed out us as extremists, which is, you know, ridiculous. We're intellectuals, and we invite intellectuals to a normal debate that should be a natural part in any democracy. But there's nothing extreme about it at all. But this is the type of hysterical reaction that you can expect from a society that has, I would call it a sectarian mindset, basically. And the funny thing is that after that report was released, the radio interviewed the main author of that report, a researcher, Tore Bjørgo is called, and he said that, yeah, no, maybe they don't do anything illegal, but they're still extremists because maybe they can make other people feel uncomfortable about participating in the democratic debate, when that is exactly what they do through stigmatizing and vilifying people who participate in
debate. They just don't see it, man. They just, it's impossible for them to see it. I know, it's hilarious. It should be like a clear, wait a minute, this is literally taking part in the democratic discourse, right? Of underlining, of taking part in cultural questions, political questions, questions of ideology, question of policy, really. I mean, if you think about it, and I battled with this all the time too. It's like, we talk about policy. We might be anti-immigration, but that doesn't mean that we go around and target a specific immigrant or something and terrorize them or something. Like, we're talking about the kind of policy which has been implemented above our heads, if you will, by the democratic leadership, right? Our leaders have just done this towards us, or it's NGOs in some regards. There's other influential groups which haven't been democratically elected that are lobbying for our countries to change in this radical way. And so we come in there and say, hey, we should change this policy. Like, we should be allowed to vote on this issue, for example, right? And that's enough for them to say, well, that's anti-democratic. You need to be shut down, right?
Yes, that's newspeak, yes. Yes, and it's quite obvious that when the state engages in this type of portrayals of just ordinary citizens participating in the debate, that is just a form of political intimidation. They want to scare you off from participating in these things. We saw the same things happen in Sweden. Was that in 2013, I think, when the big newspapers basically hired Antifa people to dox ordinary citizens who had commented on news items online, and then, well, the end result was that people lost their job. One person even committed suicide. So this is a form of political intimidation and a sort of low intensive terror against the population to scare them off from participating in the debate. And it's extremely effective, of course, you know, apparently. But that is basically what we have to, that's why we have to normalize these things. We have to just take these battles to demand our place in the debate, basically. And it's quite ironic because the Antifa has this talking point that basically ideas are violence, that disagreeing with them is equal to violence, basically. So all violence they commit against people who don't agree with them is just in self-defense.
Yeah,
because
I've
ideas
heard that
in
too.
Themselves yeah. are violent. Yeah.
Exactly. Or is this idea that it'll, without proof, obviously, but they argue, and they do this from a historical point of view, by the way, which is, you know, pertinent to what you just brought up and why that discussion to a certain extent needs to be had as well. That it's always, well, it will lead to X, Y, Z. It's like, no, you need to prove that then, establish that, to show us where talking about these kinds of things. Well, it's demonization and blah, blah, blah. But wait a minute, all of these things have been done to us undemocratically anyway. So they've already violated one of their own core principles of letting ordinary people in on the decision making. And again, these things of radically transforming a country demographically, like we've seen with many Western European nations now, I mean, it's one of the biggest things you can imagine being done to a country. It's a radical, transformative, civilization-altering experience that everyone is subjected to, and we're just expected not to say anything or just not to notice it because it's not nice. I mean, what do they want?
Yeah, 100 years ago, Sweden was one of the most ethnically homogeneous countries in the world, on the planet, and in 1975. The parliament passed a new decision that Sweden was to become multicultural. And the latest projections I've seen, I mean, these statistics are very difficult to find because the government doesn't really have any statistics, any clear statistics on these things. But from what researchers have been able to gather, the latest projections are that within 30, 40 years, Swedes are an ethnic minority in Sweden. And of course, that's in the total population. But if you look at the relevant figures, which is the fertile part of the population, Swedes are becoming older because they're having no kids, basically, and the immigrants are young. So the tipping point is much earlier. So basically, we have gone in historically speaking, a few decades from being an ethnic homogeneous country to being an ethnic minority in our own countries, and that is the most extreme. That is the most extreme change that you can ever imagine, that you replace the population, you replace the very people. So when you talk about politics now, you're not even talking about the future of your own kids. You're talking about the future of other people. And they try to portray just rational discussion about these topics as extremism. That's the absurd part of
this. And why do they do that? Well, because this is an agenda and they play to win, right? Otherwise, it would be like, all right, well, we can talk. It's just like any other policy. It's like the tax rates or, you know, whatever, right? But it's not. It's an extremely important area to them, which is basically, it's a boundary there of basically you do not address this. If you address this, you're not only unpolite, you're in fact racist, you're a neo-Nazi, you know, we've heard it all, right? But it's done they've weaponized these things and they've made them guilt-ridden so that we won't address it, so that it will happen and occur, so that their agenda will be fulfilled, right? That's how I see it. I can't really view it in any other way, that this is vitally important to the globalists, let's say, and those who wants to, I guess that's the easiest way we can explain it. They want to globalize the world, and the idea of the nation state is over. And the best way to do that is to eradicate that which has upheld the nation state in the past, and that's of course the ethnic groups that lives in the nation. How do you see it?
Yes, these people are not Democrats, of course. They don't care what the people thinks. They have ideas of democratic values, which is just a term they use. They don't believe in the democratic process. So either democracy is a process, which is people vote and what the majority thinks is what sort of wins, or democracy is a set of values and it doesn't really matter what the people think, and then it just means something other than democracy. It's not majority rule in any case. The perfect example is, of course, the reactions to Brexit. In the summer of 2016, the British people voted, and the majority voted to go out of the EU, to leave the EU, to become, to regain their sovereignty. And still, that hasn't happened. And all throughout these years, the default position in the debate has been sort of, well, should we disregard this election or this referendum, or should we implement it, or in what extent should we leave the EU? You know, it's the default position is that the globalists win, and if the people say something else, it's just a matter of how to ignore what the people say, you know. Because if the election, if the referendum result was the other way around, that the people voted to stay in the EU, you would never. It's inconceivable to see the people in power discussing, well, how should we leave anyway, despite the people want to stay. It's inconceivable. It's always the elites deciding, and if the population, if the people think something else, then that's just sort of a little hurdle they have to get past.
Yeah. And did you see the latest with that, by the way? Theresa May's deal was what do you call it? It was not approved, right, by the parliament. So now they have to go back to the draw. It's almost like and this was kind of early on in the process, I guess, but it's like I just felt that they are going to make an example out of the UK as well, right? Because think of it. If they are able to leave successfully with a good deal and a good economic standing and stuff like that, it will basically give a signal to the other countries, right? Actually, we can do this. We can pull it off. I think they intend to make this into a nightmare scenario, where I saw that they're preparing like prepper boxes and stuff with, like, in case, the border is shut down, or there's an imposition, or they impose tariffs really high, or importation laws is going to screw up so that people can, you know, basically get fed for like 2-3 weeks, before things are sorted out. So the Brexit boxes is on sale right now in the UK to potentially, get yourself out of this situation. But regardless, what I'm saying is I think it was planned to not be successful. It was the intention was to sabotage it, to make an example out of them.
Yes, and you can also see it in how the mass media portrays this. For example, the mass media in Sweden, when that election took place, or that referendum took place, mass media in Sweden was criticized for only interviewing people who wanted to stay in the EU. And their defense was that they couldn't find anyone who voted to leave. Well, it's weird that the majority voted to leave, but you can't find them. And it's always, and it's always that way they portray these things. It's the same thing with Donald Trump, the Trump election. That the way they portray it is that how could this guy get elected? No one voted for him. You know, it's like everyone knows that this is just some sort of accident.
The hiccup in the arc towards progress, you know.
It's not this is what people actually want, right, or vote for. It's just some huge misunderstanding. How could this happen? And they just, and the way the mass media talks to the people is that, well, we all know that this is just a silly thing that happened, that basyway no one voted for him, but he was elected anyway. It's a weird schizophrenia about these things.
Yeah, and it's a very elitist one, of course, and this is no surprise to us, but you know, you can really see them starting to talk down to the regular normal people out there. You've seen comments like this from media pundits in Sweden too, that people living on the countryside, they're like backwards and really idiotic and they don't know what they're doing. You know, anyone who votes for like, you know, Sweden Democrats and, you know, things like that, it's a constant talking you down to. And I'm just waiting for that time when like, and I guess to a certain extent, Brexit is kind of a sign of things to come, that you basically just have a political elite which bypasses the will of the people and say, you know what, like, you don't know what you're doing. Actually, this voting thing is a bad idea. We're just going to go ahead and decide for you because we know what's best for you.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that the social democratic establishment in Sweden, which was established on the talking point that they were protecting working class interests, basically, that very establishment, both the political establishment and the mass media establishment, they have now made one of their major talking points is that the people who vote against this process of mass immigration, they are uneducated and just working class. So the SAP, Socialdemokratiska Arbetarpartiet, the Social Democratic Workers Party, you know, they are against workers, and that is you know, yet another Orwellian twist in the whole political establishment. And of course, the major part is that not only are the working class, that they are not put through this university education where they're brainwashed even more, they are also the ones getting the consequences of mass immigrations, because they live in these neighborhoods that are harmed by mass immigration. And of course, they are the ones who are most likely to react against it, because they are harmed in their day-to-day lives. And it's a betrayal. It's a betrayal that the Social Democrats and these political establishments have just disregarded the future of the people they are there to rule, basically, and whose interests they should protect. And it's the same thing with the union movements, the Fackföreningsrörelsen and unions, that have protected to, or that have claimed to work to raise workers' wages. And the only thing that globalization does when you break down the natural borders is that you import cheap labor, which means that the salaries drop, of course, which only harms the working class. So they are really the ones getting a brutal treatment in this process.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you followed the formation of the new government? I haven't in the last couple of days or so. Is that set? Did you keep up with it? I think the current Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, he's gonna stay, right? And they did manage to basically get let's put it this way. The true colors of these supposed conservatives and centrist or center-right parties, they show their true colors, because they did decide to work with far left parties, as opposed to actually making a coalition together with the Sweden Democrats to be able to form a government and be in power and rule, right? They actually chose to say, here you go, leftists, you take charge of the country, because we're not going to touch the Sweden Democrats.
Yeah, this is actually in one way a good thing, because it shows, like you said, it shows their true colors, because they pretend to have this fight between the left and the right in the political establishment, when the only thing that really matters is that this replacement migration continues.
Yeah.
Continues, at the same rate as it has, and preferably just, and there you have, yeah, Minister of Culture, Amanda Lind.
I was just looking at that, and it's this lady, by the way. what is going on with this here?
That is the new Swedish minister. It's Moldilocks.
That's right, exactly. Yep, you're
Moldilocks
right.
Moldilocks is the new Swedish Minister of Culture, and
she's a Green Party.
I read an the Green Party, and I read an interview with her, and she is interested in role-playing games and comic books.
Nice.
Yep. No joke.
Yep. And is this the same? Let me see here. Minister for Culture and Democracy. No, I was thinking about, there's another cultural organization. I actually ended up doing a video about that a while ago. that was handed over to an Iranian, which has hardly studied any Swedish. I actually forget his name now. I did a video on it, but this is another position, and this is just, this makes sense though, right? Because this is basically people who are far left, and if you look at the makeup of the people in the media, there is a vast overrepresentation of Green Party supporters, I guess, and voters when it comes to like state media, like SVT and SR Sweden Radio and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's the funny thing, because even when the which is, you know, part of the, I guess you could call it part of the deep state, the establishment media, and the government run media, SVT and SR, the Swedish Radio and Swedish Television, the government run TV and radio channels, they do not reflect the people in power, because when the left is in power, you have these extreme left journalists, which are, you know, not even by Swedish standards, standard mainstream leftists. They are fringe leftists, Miljöpartiet and so on.
Yeah.
And even when the I don't want to call them conservatives, but the slightly more right bloc runs Sweden, you still have those fringe leftist journalists. So nothing changes. It's like they say in, there's a saying in America that when the Democrats win an election, they run the country, and when the Republicans win, they are in office. You have the same thing in Sweden. It affects nothing, and these elections really are just reality shows on TV. Political power is in the framework of the debate, because all basically what you have is just a set of identical political parties.
Yeah, that's right. And of course they do end up and that's why it's so important with the cultural discourse, the metapolitical work, because as you said, there's no one really on the political spectrum that's in a position of influence and power that really sets up a true opposition to this insanity. It's all the same. It's basically just different rates that even when you have someone like Trump in, it's still like, no. Like, we need a border, but we need legal immigration. We just want to have, they're still going to have like a million people per year coming into the country, right? So it's just a matter of how quick do you want the replacement? Is it like, you know, just driving into a brick wall, or is it just kind of slow and steady going over the cliff? And at some point you have to have that dialogue, that discourse. They're like, hey, wait a minute. If we don't do anything about this, the native born populations will become a minority. And the question is, I don't think most people out there want that, but they just don't, for some reason, they just don't put those dots together, and they just don't, I mean, you never see that discourse in like mainstream media, reports on it that says, oh, demographically, we're going to become a minority, maybe passing, maybe a tiny little footnote somewhere, but that's basically it.
Yeah, a female friend of mine who has little kids, she said that it's exactly like you talk to a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. Yeah, you give them two options that you would like, you know. Would you like this sweater or this sweater? And it gives them the illusion of that they have a choice. And that's basically the nature of modern democracy. And because you never go to the fundamental questions. You just go to the superficial things. And if you by accident talk about the fundamental questions, they just ignore what you think anyways. Because it's not an accident that mass immigration started around the same time, in the same decades, all over the white world. And it has continued, you know, without slowing down, no matter who is in office or in power, what political party is in the government at that time. It doesn't change. Nothing happens. And often you have, Sweden has this really vile good cop, bad cop, dialogue between the left and the right, just to use those terms, that the left always criticizes the right of being having an inhumane immigration policy, whereas in reality the right always increases mass immigration. It's always under right-wing governments that immigration increases. So it's just a false dialogue. It's a false debate.
What is the excuse for that, do you think? Is it Is it economy? Is it the free market? Is it we need people to fulfill, you know, all the jobs that supposedly are there, which is another false talking point. But is that the excuse, or what are they using as the excuse for that?
Well, there are, of course, many factors involved. But one factor is that ethnicity is a non-issue. Nowhere on the political spectrum are you allowed to bring up ethnicity and ancestry as a relevant criterion for identity, basically. And that goes for the right, and it goes for the left. So whatever they discuss between them is just practical. What's the most practical solutions for it? They never differ on fundamental values, and that's the huge problem. They never go to the root questions of what kind of society we want. They just assume those things, and then they go to how to implement it. They, you know, having an ethno state is never an option. And that's what metapolitics is really about. That we want to present the fundamental values that we want in our society and in the society we want to leave to the future generations of our children and children's children and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something which is highlighted and discussed. And again, it's just such an important thing. And that's why we talk about it so much and highlight it and try just the best we can to bring it to people's attention. Because again, I think if people were truly aware, they would not want it. And in fact, if we got a chance to vote on it, I would assume that I think like, you know, at least like 80% of the Swedish, if not even more, of the native Swedish population would say, no, we don't want it, right? What's the boon? It's like, I mean, again, it's like this, as you say, it's like this self, not self-explanatory, but it's this like obvious
self-evident.
Self-evident, thanks, exactly. Self-evident truth that like diversity is a strength and we all need it and it's so wonderful and great and whatnot, but it's like it's a cruel and tyrannical way that it's being brought to us and being enforced, you know, against us, against our will, basically. Which again just puts me back at that same place where we were earlier, that it must be the most important priority to them. Like, this is the number one issue. If there's any other stuff that can wait, forget about it. Economy doesn't matter. Workers' rights doesn't matter. Why do you think that it is so important to them to execute this agenda in the West?
Oh, that's a difficult question because it has so many factors in it. I mean, obviously there are hostile elites who really want to destroy us. Others are just hooked on this new mythology that all nationalism leads to the Holocaust, for example, or to slavery and just, you know, when the mass media starts portraying things in films and in the news and so on, in TV entertainment and so on, these things also affect the elites. So the elites have also absorbed these ideas and images of the evil of nationalism and national identity and traditional, you know, normal values. We can never forget that, you know, by today's standards, even Karl Marx would be considered a Nazi, basically. So that's how much values have deteriorated over the last few decades. And in the end, it also becomes a bit about prestige. They don't wanna, they've pushed this things for so long, and to stop now would be admitting that it was a huge crime, basically. And they don't wanna admit to that. There are many psychological factors involved. But of course, there are elites who genuinely want to harm us, and there are elites who really think that they will create a utopia, you know, the Soros people who really think that national boundaries are an innate evil, and that really think that the global liberal world is just a utopia, and everything we see now is just what do you call it? Födslovåndor, the pangs of pain when you give birth to this new utopia. You know, it's just small problems on the way.
You've got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, as I say, right?
Yes.
Whatever sacrifices happen along the way, including like you know, turning their own their own population into a minority, and possibly, and I think we're right on this point, but probably a hated and despised minority too. By the way, not the kind of minorities that we had in our countries in the early days, where we took, you know, well care of them, and again, of course, it's just, I'm not suggesting that there never was anybody that had a bad experience or anything like that, but it's like, it's a, I mean, we see the rates of crime and of shootings and bombs and new kinds of crime, gang rapes, of course, being one of the big ones, in Sweden, but they're willing to just look to the side of this and not really address it. In that regard, women's rights, screw that, doesn't matter. You know, workers' rights, doesn't matter. It's all this number one priority. So they're cold-hearted. They're cruel people, those who do this to us.
Yeah, I think it was Gregory Hood who wrote an article five years ago, at Countercurrents, that the title was something like "The War on Whites is All They Have." And basically what he argued in that article, which is a brilliant article, is that when anti-whiteness comes into conflict with other values in the modern world, in the modern paradigm, all the other values have to give way to anti-whiteness. So if there is a conflict of interest, for example, let's say between feminism and bringing in huge amounts of extremely patriarchal Muslims, then the feminists have to give way, because it's more important to bring in the Muslims. If the working class movement has interest in keeping working class wages up, and mass immigration will bring those wages down, that working class has to give way to mass immigration, because anti-whiteness is the top priority there. The environmentalist movement just consider the fact that that globalization is going to bring the industrialized lifestyle to the entire planet and bring more people into live in a more harmful way to the planet. The environmentalists will have to give way to mass immigration, because that is the top priority. That is the sacred value in today's society. So all the other values are slightly lower.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. You know, we're going to continue to talk more about the agenda of the liberal world order, what they're doing and how they're executing it. And I want to get into a little bit later too, obviously, what we can do to inject ourselves into that and raise the awareness of people and help to wake them up and realize what it is that's being done to them. If you see solutions being at the poll, voting Democratic, etc., or if it's more metapolitical, we can talk a bit about culture as well. But before we do that and take a break here, let's just plug the conference a little bit. It's coming up here in March 30th. So at the time of this recording, it's exactly in 2 months from now. It's back in Stockholm again this time. Tell us about it. Tell us about where people can get tickets, who's speaking, etc. Give us all the details.
Right. So we've had conferences. This is the fifth Skanza Forum. I did conferences even before I started the Skanza Forum, but we've had the first one in Stockholm, the second one in Oslo, the third one in Stockholm as well, and the fourth one in Copenhagen. Now we're back in Stockholm, because that is the major arena, and we expect to get a lot of people there as well. So it's going to be a very good conference. It's on the March 30th, that is the last Saturday in March. We have a great list of speakers. We have Jared Taylor. Everyone knows who Jared Taylor is. He runs the American Renaissance AMREN conference and so on. Olena Semenyaka, she is a Ukrainian. She is a Ukrainian intellectual. She's also going to speak in Finland afterwards. She's a really good intellectual. She's a really good speaker. Greg Johnson, he has spoken at all our conferences. He is a regular speaker with us. He is a PhD in philosophy. He runs Countercurrents Publishing and has written several books, also The White Nationalist Manifesto. Mark Collett, who has a huge YouTube channel, is very popular on YouTube, British guy, does really great work. I'm really looking forward to him. This is his first conference with us. And what we're going to talk about is anarcho-tyranny. We can maybe get back to that a bit later. Anarcho-tyranny is a term coined by Sam Francis in the early 90s. It basically means that it's a description of society today, that the combination of anarchy and tyranny. Anarchy refers to the fact that the states, the governments basically have lost control over their own borders. They even fight their own borders. They try to dissolve their own borders. They have lost control over mass immigration and so on. And they've lost control over crime. So basically what ordinary law-abiding citizens face is anarchy. They are not protected by the state anymore because the state has lost control over rampant crime, basically. And then you have that combined with tyranny because the governments will enforce laws more strictly against the law-abiding people. So the law-abiding people have this sort of like a sandwich, you know, from both sides. They get pressure from anarchy and from above, you know, from the tyranny of the governments and the huge corporations, of course, with deplatforming, with strict law enforcement, what I described earlier with government institutions fighting the very people who just try to protest against this anarchy. And you've all seen the deplatforming from YouTube, from Twitter, from PayPal. You are basically treated as a second-class citizen, and you're really harassed from above, and that is the tyrannical part. And so those are the topics for debate, and that's going to be a really good debate because we are in the center of anarcho-tyranny right now. But the most important part is that you will get a chance to both meet the speakers, maybe speakers you have followed for a long time, but most of all, you get to network with real live people and create your own social networks. People always come up to me and say that, well, I went to your conference and I met people there, and that was the tipping point for me when I started to get really involved. Because let's face it, people are not only rational, they don't only listen to arguments, they're social creatures. And when society from above, when the government, when the corporations and so on try to push us out of polite society, we have to have a social network around us. So please send me if you want to come. If you live in Scandinavia, we also get visitors from around the world. People fly in from all over to partake in our events. Send me an email to info@scanzaforum.com. And one thing that is very important to bring up is the vetting process, because we want our visitors to feel safe. So we will have a vetting process for everyone who wants to register. And basically, there are two ways that you can get approved to get an invitation. One is by recommendation, that you get someone we know who's been to a previous conference or someone else who we know to vouch for you, to just say that, I know this guy or girl, I know that they want to come with honest intentions to participate in the event. If you don't know anyone, it's not impossible. You just send us an email and you give us some sort of identification, because this has to be a two-way process of trust, basically. If we're going to trust you to let you into our events, you have to trust us with letting us know who you are, basically. We don't want any anonymous people there, because we do care about the safety of everyone there and the speakers as well.
And you have to think about that these days. You've seen they're going with like their hidden cameras, and I mean it's pathetic. But this is what they do. They somehow think that they're stopping evil from manifesting in the world or something like that. They're like religiously driven by this, but they go in and supposedly catch people because you know at conferences and stuff. So I definitely understand that part, and I think it's a good thing. To have it that way, at least so the people there, as you say, can feel that they can have, they can be safe. They're not going to be exposed for being interested in different political ideas and stuff like that. So that's a good way. But yeah, so we have the email address up on screen, guys. But for radio listeners, for podcast version, if you will, info@scanzaforum.com, and that SCANDZA forum, scanzaforum.com. Okay, so that looks like a good conference, Frode. A lot of good people there. You're going to be speaking to, so that's going to be a lot of fun. March 30th in Stockholm. So definitely check it out, guys, if you want to go and if you can attend. So it was a lot of fun. Anything else you want to say about the event before we take a break, Frode?
Well, yeah, it's just to emphasize again that we've had all these great speakers, and it's always very appreciated. We put many of the speeches up on YouTube, and you guys at Red Eyes have helped us with that at a couple of conferences. Always really good quality, but the main thing is to come there for the social reasons, to network with people, to meet others, because so many people out there. I know that there are so many people out there who feel that they are alone with their ideas and their worries about the future. They have kids, they want to do something, they don't feel they can put their name or their face out there, but they really need to interact with someone, because if you just isolate yourself with these ideas, you will go insane. Basically, so many people just feel frustrated about what's happening. They worry about their kids' future, they see everything that's going on in society around them. They don't feel they can do anything about it. The best thing you can do, the very best thing, is to interact with other people, to meet other people, to get involved with something productive, to do stuff that really matters for the future. And for that, you have to interact and network with other people. That's the most important thing. And so many people just feel a sense of relief just coming there. It's an oasis, you know? They finally get to talk to sane people. And that's the core value that you can breathe in a room full of sane people, hundreds of people who just think normally about these things for once.
Exactly, and as you said, an important aspect of it is to get people to kind of get over that tipping point, that threshold maybe. Mm-hmm. Getting involved, because that's ultimately, if we don't have more people involved, we're not gonna make this. You know, this is the right place to be. This is the moral right battle to be involved in. We really are facing an evil empire that are homogenizing and displacing us, and to fight back against this is the most fundamental, basic, instinctual drive that we can have and listen to. You know, to that feeling that we have about this, that something is not right, is being done to us by force, and we need more people. Everyone out there need to get involved, whether that's supporting people who do, you know, talk about this and like Frode puts on conferences about this, that's the very least you can do. But then, of course, next step is to get out there, meet more people, get engaged, get involved, build connections and networking. It's very important, and we have to, people have to realize that no one else is going to do this for you. You have to get involved. You have to do something. Otherwise, you know, we will be lost. And I know that in many cases it's hard, it's difficult. I guess last thing I want to say about it, but it, you know, a lot of people are, you know, they are in a position where like, well, what can I get, or what do I benefit from this, or whatever. But the reality is that people have to understand that what we're fighting for here is the future for our children. And if we don't do anything, if we don't, as parents, as fathers, as mothers, and et cetera, anyone out there listening, if we don't, you know, try to take this beast by the reins and control it, we're going to be, it's going to be nothing left for it. They're going to run it into the ground, and that'll be that when it comes to our nations. I'm not saying that it's over at that point, but in terms of how we know, Europe today, how we know the West today, that is going to be, lost and over if we don't put our foot down and do something about this.
Yeah. And another value, of course, of this is that, you know, I was a part of nationalism when it was a very marginalized movement, and with, quite frankly, a bit weird people. but nowadays we have so many top quality people. We have lawyers, we have professors, we have all kinds of successful business people and so on. And one of the main benefits of having these real life social networks where you meet face to face, because, yeah, you're not going to get that trust over the internet. You have to meet face to face to know what a person is, who a person is. And I know so many people who have gotten into difficult situations with their involvement in politics, they have maybe lost their job or whatever, and they have been helped by people they have met at events like this. So these things are crucial for basically your future. You have to participate in real life interaction with other people, because that is, arguments, reading online, commenting online will only take you so far. You have to become a real person in other people's eyes, so to speak. You have to interact really with other people to really get to that next level.
Of course, absolutely. All right, folks, you got all the details. Check the description as well for links and everything we've been talking about. Yeah, but yeah, thank you, Frode, for the first segment. Stay with us, everybody. We're going to continue in part two at redicemembers.com. Check it out if you want to hear more from Frode. We'll continue to talk much more about anarcho-tyranny. We'll talk about the demographic situation, how we can turn things around, what Frode has in terms of ideas of changing things a little bit and go moving in the right direction. Where is the work most needed? Is it culture? Is it politics? Is it a little bit of both? Anyway, we'll get into that and a lot more in the second part. So stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back.